Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside.
Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, welcome, welcome back to the Bob Leftsets podcast. My guest today is Chris Difford of Squeeze. Chris?
Wow, so wonderful to be here.
Okay, so where are you right this very second?
I'm in my garden shed, and it's just bliss to be here. It's a kind of spiritual place for me to be.
Okay, so your shed, which I can see, but this is an audio podcast, to what degree can you do recording there?
Well, I don't, because as primarily as a lyricist, I leave all the recording to the clever people. So I sit here and do what I can do. So I've been doing in lockdown Zoom concerts, and I've been doing songwriting tutorials. Today I had 16 people on my screen, and we were working on different songs together. It was kind of weird, but fun.
Okay, how did you decide to do the tutorials?
Well, I've been running songwriting camps for 26 years. I first started at Miles Copeland's castle in 91, I think it was. And when I drove home from France, having been at his retreat, which I loved, it was fun. I just thought it was a bit sort of tight. You know, everybody had to be involved in his company. So I came home and I found a really big house in the country. I rented it with EMI Publishing, and we got Lamont Dozier, and we got Kirsty McCall, and we got Suggs and Graham Gouldman in the house, along with lots of other great people. And we just sat and wrote songs, and I've been doing it ever since.
Is it lucrative?
No, I never get paid for it. I just do it because I love it, and I love putting people together, and I love hearing the songs.
And have any successful financially, commercially songs emerged from any of these camps?
Well, not so much that, but more the sort of friendships. Like Kathy Dennis was one of the first people to come, and she ended up writing with Kylie Minogue, and she's got a multi-million pound publishing deal, and I don't. So she probably wrote the right songs, and I didn't. But it's about friendships and about people that you meet, and about the songs that you write after the week. You know, it's kind of just like being in rehab.
And to what degree can you teach songwriting?
You can't. You can't at all. That's what I found out. But what you can do is just put people in a room and say to them, okay, this is the project, and you know, make cups of tea, and just hope that people can cross-pollinate. I think that's the word that I would use. And they do. So the people that I've been working with this week are all sponsored by Help Musicians, which is a charity. So these are all musicians that are out of work. These are people that are struggling, and they're eager to do something different because they've been locked down for 3 months. So they come on the screen, and I give them various projects, and I put them in groups, and they go off and write songs. And it's just amazing to hear what they come back with. You know, it's just brilliant.
And what might the assignment be?
Well, the assignment, the first one that I do is I ask them to get a photograph from their house, choose a photograph, bring it to the screen, show me the photograph. And then I ask them to look at the photograph and take it as inspiration for a lyric. And then they go off for the day and then they come back with a completed lyric based around the photograph that they've seen. And I only know that it works because when I wrote a song called Label But Love for the East Side Story album, it was inspired by a Cartier-Bresson photograph that I saw in a book around that, about 1981, I think.
And so these, what about the music side of it?
Well, the music side is really up to them, what they bring to the table. Some people are very basic in the way that they record, and that's great. And yet there are a couple of producers that have been online today, and they come back with almost the finished product. And I'm sitting here with my chin on the floor thinking, how do these guys do it? It's just amazing. I just feel like a lazy sod, you know, but it's just brilliant the way they do it.
Okay, and you have done how many since COVID era?
I'm on my fifth week.
Wow, wow. So now you're located near Brighton?
Yeah, I'm about 10 miles east of Brighton in the South Downs, right next to a place called Charleston.
And how did you end up in that area?
Well, it's a bit of a tale. I was in a deep, dark place, and I read a book.
This was how long ago were you in this deep, dark place?
About 10 years ago.
Okay.
And it was one of my many dark holes that I've been in. But this one was pretty dark, and I'd read a book by a vicar called Peter Owen Jones. And I went to Brighton to hear him read from his book at a bookshop. And I queued up with the book to get him to sign it. It was a very inspirational read. And when I met him, I said, I'd really like to have one-to-one counsel with you. So he invited me to the village that I now live in. And I sat with him for 45 minutes and just spoke about how I felt. And he didn't say a word. He just had a little cigarette on the go. And then he turned to me and he said, you know, what I think you need is community. And what I think you need is somewhere to live. And we walked outside of his house, just down the road, and we walked into a house, and he said, you will live here.
And is that the house you're in?
Exactly.
So that begs the question, to what degree are you integrated in the community?
Well, I've done lots of shows to raise money for the roof of the church. I love the community here. It's a really special place. It's been here since Henry VIII's time, this particular village. It's got the lord of the manor, but it's also got the baker. You know, it's also got the pub and the post office. It's very gentle, and it's kind of completely different from being on a tour bus, and that's why I like it, I think.
Let's go back to the beginning. Speaking of the church, are you a believer?
Am I a believer like the monkeys? Yeah, I suppose I am a believer in something. I'm a believer in fate, and I'm a believer in love, and I'm a believer of commitment, I guess. But it's taken a long time for that to happen.
So I must admit, I don't find that much fulfillment from a lot of interactions. Do you find yourself getting fulfilled by talking to the baker and the other shop people? And do you see any of these people outside of the work context?
Not really. I mean, I sort of come and go to the village because I'm up until just recently, obviously, I was on the road all the time. So, for instance, this year, I would have been away for 5 or 6 months. So to actually be at home in the village and to get to know each other, is a kind of new experience for us all. And we all cover for each other. It's kind of a lockdown village. And I have to say, it's like being what I would imagine it would have been like in the Second World War. One of the things at the beginning of lockdown that was quite odd was there was no sound of aeroplanes in the sky because they stopped flying, obviously. And whenever there was a plane, people would run into the garden to see what it was. It was like, so I can imagine that must have been like that in the Second World War. You see a plane, you run outside, you think, what is that?
Okay, let's go back to the deep, dark spaces. Is this something that you've noticed throughout your lifetime?
Yeah, I trip myself up from time to time. It's been my own fault, my own journey, and I wouldn't have it any other way, I guess. You know, the thing that I wanted most when I was a teenager was to be in a band. My parents didn't want me to be in a band. They said that I would end up a drug addict, an alcoholic, and skint, and they were absolutely right.
But I guess what I'm asking, you know, depression, a lot of artists, successful artists, suffer from depression, and you seem to go on that, but by the same token, you're open to ideas. Have you been in therapy or taken any medication for this depression?
Yeah. 28 years ago, I went into rehab for the first time, and it was an experience I wasn't expecting. A good friend picked me up. Literally from the street and took me in. And I have to say it was a big turning point in my career and in my life. I'd neglected a lot of relationships, the most important ones. And I learned how to kind of stand on my own two feet a little bit more and actually know who I was for the first time, I guess. So 28 years ago, I started that, and there's been therapy ever since, here and there. And, it's not an easy ride having depression in the back of your mind, but, you know, day by day it gets easier, I think. And the only person who's going to make it more confusing is me.
Well, getting older, people become happier, which is one of the good advantages of getting older. But do you feel that your depression aligns with alienation? And to what degree is that an inspiration for your work?
Well, I'm good at isolating. So it's not alienation, it's isolation from my point of view. And, you know, there I was in a very successful band up on stage, Madison Square Garden, and having a great time playing stadiums with David Bowie and what have you, and you two. And all I really wanted to do was go back to my hotel room and be on my own, which is kind of odd. You know, every other person in the band was out drinking, having a great time, dancing. And I was kind of just like, oh, no, I don't want to do that. I just want to go back to my room. So, you know, those are the golden days, let's face it. You know, you had to go there to understand what it was all about in the first place. We just played Madison Square Garden and in February, and apparently we played it twice before, but I didn't remember that.
Wow. Okay. When you wanted to go back to your room when you were at the peak of the commercial success, what was going through your brain? Why did you want to be in your room?
I wanted to be in the room so that I could, I suppose, enjoy the drink and the drugs without anybody else around. I didn't want to share what I had. I had friends that would maybe pop by. And the odd thing was that no one in the band really twigged what was going on apart from our drummer, Gilson. He got sober before I did, and he became a big inspiration for me. But when I went into rehab, I think everybody was really surprised. They thought, well, why is this guy going in? He seems quite normal to us. And I can kind of get it. You know, it wasn't like I was Keith Moon or, you know, I wasn't sort of staggering around driving cars into swimming pools. I was kind of trying to keep an even keel.
And frequently people are reluctant to go to rehab. Had people tried previously, or why were you open to it at that particular moment?
Well, my drug dealer came back from America and he had sobered up, and that really confused me and upset me. And he said, you should try this. And he'd lost weight and he looked brilliant. And I thought, I don't want to do that. I'm not ready for this. And then one day I was about to go on a plane on another American tour with Squeeze. And I went to say goodbye to my children who were living in London, and I broke down. And this guy, he came to pick me up, And he didn't really give me many options. He just said, look, you know, I think this is the time for you to sort your life out. And I said, well, what about Squeeze? They're waiting at the airport. He said, that'll be fine. And it was. And they all carried on the tour and sent lovely letters to me and supported me.
That begs a question. Have you been clean since that time?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, 28 years.
And so when you play a gig, like you say you played Madison Square Garden recently, do you still want to go back to your room alone?
That's a good question. No, I mean, I like my own regime. I like the back of the bus. I like my own space. And I think everybody in the band does. As you get older and you're in a band, you want your own space. You know, when you're first on an American tour, or you're first on a tour and you're in a minibus like we were in 1979, we couldn't, you know, we just wanted to be close to each other all the time. You know, we were like stuck together like glue going around America having a great time. And then as you get older, you want, hold on a minute, I want my space.
That also begs the question of a lot of acts are on the road, classic or heritage acts, as they say, and they're on the road primarily for the money and they hate each other. Have you had any of that experience where I'll see you on stage, but I don't want to see you anywhere else?
No, good Lord, I could not do that for a moment. I've seen it in other bands, actually. Yeah, I've seen it and I've heard about it, read about it. But that wouldn't work with Squeeze. We're very much a musical unit. We may have our differences from time to time, but our similarities are great, and the similarities are the songs, really. And, you know, Glenn and I have grown up together for 48 years, writing fantastic songs, I think. And, you know, now we need our space.
Okay, you're only a year younger than me. At this late date, are you happy with what you have achieved, or do you still feel there's a grail you want to reach towards? What are your thoughts on that?
I've been thinking a lot about that recently. There are lots of goals, I believe, to head for. You know, and I think I'm lucky enough to be healthy, and I seem to still be creative. My imagination still seems to be in the right place. So I'm eager to write new records. I'm learning all the time about musical theatre, which is something that I've had a passion for many years. And I may not ever write a musical, but it's something that I feel very strongly that I need to learn. And yeah, I mean, there's always something new to do. I don't want to be a nostalgia band where we just go up and do the hits. I don't think that would wear very well with our fans.
But to what degree is it inhibiting? You know, when you started out, it was the pre-internet era. And certainly anybody who had to deal with a major label, the audience was aware of them. Whereas today, even if you're a new act, but certainly someone who's already had success, you can make new material and almost no one can hear it. And even fans will come to the show and a great number won't listen. To what degree does that make it so you don't want to create at all?
I don't really have any connection with that feeling. I mean, if somebody comes to the gig because they want to hear Black Coffee in Bed or Pulling Muscles from Michelle because it reminds them of being at college or the first girlfriend that they had or something like that, that's amazing. That's a respect. If they hear a new song and they just their mind drifts, I understand that. Totally. I mean, I've been to see bands, you know, like a couple of years ago. I love Elvis Costello. He's a dear friend. And I go and I listen to the new songs and it takes me a while to take it on board. You know, I kind of hold on a minute. You know, I'm waiting for Oliver's Army, please. And then you can give me some new songs. And then he gives me the new songs and I'm diving into the lyrics and I'm thinking, wow, what an incredible writer. But I want Oliver's Army.
Okay, so you don't lack for motivation.
I don't lack for motivation. And I think maybe that's true of the whole of Squeeze. You know, when we're working together as a unit, which is a wonderful thing, we all have motivation.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
Every week, we'll pick a new song from the list and talk about their placement on the revamped 2021 list.
We'll also have guests join us, ranging from the artists themselves to the producers, or simply other writers like ourselves who voted on them.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern-day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside and Britney Spears' Baby One More Time.
There's so many fascinating stories that have been forgotten, like Midnight Train to Georgia starting with a phone call to Farrah Fawcett, or how the Yeah Yeah Yeahs inspired Kelly Clarkson's banger Since You've Been Gone and Beyoncé's Hold Up. Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rock the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James. LeBron James.
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, now, there was a time when you shifted, and you went into this in a book you recently wrote, you shifted from being a performer to being a more behind-the-scenes person, first as a songwriter with other people, and then as a manager. What were your thoughts? Did you feel you were giving something up? What was that change like for you?
A mentor of mine, a manager called David Enthoven, who used to manage Roxy Music, and he managed King Crimson, and he managed Squeeze, actually, for a year. He was the mentor of mine, and when I was in rehab, he was the most supportive person I could ever have had. I loved him dearly, and still do. And he called me out of the blue one day, and he said, Brian Ferry is looking for somebody to help him write lyrics for his new album. Would you like to come and meet him? And of course, I had all the Roxy Music records and Brian Ferry records, and I couldn't wait to get in the car to meet him. But I was petrified because it felt like I was going to meet Prince Charles or something. It was somebody on a different level to me. So I sat with Brian and with David, and Brian took me into his room, and he gave me books and books and books and books of one-liners, just one-liners written down on pads. And he said, I want you to sort them all out into songs. And so that was the beginning of my relationship with him. And then it transformed into becoming his personal manager, because he didn't have a personal manager, and he liked to go to dinner with me for some reason. And we liked to go to the country together for some reason. We hung out, we liked cars, we drove around a lot. And we became, you know, friends when it was cool for him. And I have to say, the hugest respect for him, although I found it difficult emotionally sometimes to work for him. And so therefore I was transformed into a sort of managerial person, and I wasn't in Squeeze. Squeeze were asleep, so I had the opportunity to do that, and I loved it.
Okay, let's go back to Brian for a second. When you started to work for him, how were you doing financially?
I was coasting. I was living in the country with my my partner and my two new children, and we were living on a farm. I had a recording studio, which everybody used to come and record at. Wayne Shorter came to record there, for instance. Paul Weller, Oasis, Brian Ferry. I mean, the list goes on. It's a huge list. And I really enjoyed being a proprietor of that and seeing my kids grow up. And I was peddling. It was peddling time. It was fine. I enjoyed it. And then Brian gave me a monthly wage, which was terrific. You know, it was just lovely to have a wage packet and to be at work. And because I lived in the country and he wanted me to be close by, he put me in a hotel. So I stayed in a really nice hotel just around the corner from his house for 6 months. And when we got the bill, I could have bought a flat for the price that he paid for the hotel. But it was a lovely experience for me. And yeah.
Well, if you were in the hotel for 6 months, were you separated from your family for 6 months?
Yeah, I used to go home at the weekend, apart from when Brian needed me to go to the country with him, to his country house, or we would go and do a show somewhere. So I was always on 24-hour call. That was my job, I guess. And yeah, he had an inner circle of private friends that I was not in the inner court, if you like. I was not in the inner court of the Crimson King. I was on the outside of the Crimson King.
And as far as bigger decisions, like when to go on tour, putting out albums, were you involved in that, or there was someone who was a manager who was taking care of that?
No, for a while it was David and myself and Brian making the decisions, and he just wanted to work. You know, he'd gone through a very difficult divorce, which was painful for him, and I could see that, and I felt dearly for him. You know, and he just wanted to work. You know, he wanted to earn some money and just have his mind taken off what was going on for him. So we used to get lots of corporate work. You know, he'd do private shows. And then I get a phone call from the record company and they say, Chris, you know, the one thing we would like you to achieve is to get Roxy Music back together again. And I said, you want me to get Roxy Music back together? It's like, how the hell am I going to do that? Anyway, the next phone call was from the head of a massive bank. He's got tons of money. He wants Roxy Music do a private gig for his 40th. So I call all the members of the band, apart from Brian and Eno, and they all agree to do the show. So without rehearsals, we turn up at this club, and then I think, this is my big minute. I've got them all in the dressing room. I'm going to get them to talk about reforming. And Phil Manzanera, who was the sort of catalyst in a way of trying to make it work, I stood them in the dressing room to try and get the conversation going, and it was like they'd all just, was it their first day of school? They didn't know what to say to each other. It was just weird, and so it didn't happen.
Okay, and to what degree did you end up creating artistically with Brian?
Well, I don't know if I did. I think I kind of was there as a listening post sometimes. He'd have lots of different musicians in and lots of different producers. We got Dave Stewart in, and Dave produced the album that I worked on. And Dave, being the genius that he was, he would only kind of come in for like an hour a week, but that would be enough to kind of put the match to the fireworks and set things off. And Brian, you know, Brian was very particular about his music, of course, and his whole image. And I learned a lot from his kind of style, if you like.
But what'd you learn?
I learned that it just wasn't good enough to pick any old tie out when you were going out for dinner, that you had to really give it a whole day's thought.
And just drilling a little bit further, so emotionally shifting from being on stage or behind the scenes, that was rather smooth, or the break before this made it so it was rather smooth? Or was it difficult?
Well, to work with Brian, it wasn't difficult. No, it was kind of smooth. I didn't miss squeeze at that point.
Okay, and then how did it end with Brian?
Oh, well, it ended in exhaustion, I think. Really, I was exhausted. He was exhausted. He needed a proper manager to take him to where he needed to go. I don't think I was that guy. I definitely wasn't that guy. I've been through lots of tiring days with him. And I sat in my car outside the office one day and I phoned his PA and I said, I'm not coming in. I really don't think I can do this anymore. And the next thing, I get a letter from Brian, and I've got it in my desk and I've never opened it, but it was basically a farewell letter.
And you've never opened it because?
Because I didn't need to read what he would say. I kind of, you know, he was a very giving kind of guy, and I just thought it would let the magic out of the bag. Whatever magic there was between us in that short space of time, I didn't want it to come out. I wanted it to remain in the past.
But that begs a question. Assuming you get mail, do you open your mail the day it comes?
Oh, God, yeah. But this was from Brian Ferry, and I knew it was from him because I recognized the handwriting of his PA. So it was kind of obvious.
Okay. So that's approximately 6 months?
Working with him?
Yes.
There were two different times. There was a six-month period, and then there was a year. Yeah.
And what was between those two?
There was about 2 weeks of not knowing what I was required to do. he was in a bad mood. I got sent back to the hotel. The phone didn't ring. And I just sat there and I sat there and I sat there. And then he phoned up and I came back in.
Okay. So when that ended, you went on to be a manager and manage another band.
Well, yeah, I managed a band called The Stripes, if that's who you're talking about.
Yes.
The Stripes, yeah. They were 15 years old, and they're from Ireland, from Cavan in Ireland. And they came over and asked me to produce them, and I pressed play and record on the 2-inch tape machine. They recorded about 15 songs in one take, and it was like listening to the Rolling Stones for the first time. They were just out of this world. They were young, correct. They'd learn everything off their iPads, I think, and by just dedicating themselves to the instruments that they were playing. So I was completely smitten by them. But they didn't have a manager, and I was giving them advice, I guess. I was just trying to help them out. And then I get a phone call from Elton John. And Elton John hears that I've been working with them, and he says to me, I really want that band on my label. So I said, great, you know, that sounds like amazing. He said, bring them round for Sunday lunch. So I get the whole band in my car. We drive round to Elton's house, which is for them, you know, and for me, I guess, it's like this house with, like, you know, fantastic gardens, electric gates, statues everywhere, candles in every room, flowers everywhere. Just like the nicest thing, you know. So we go in and he gives us Sunday lunch. He tells us what he's going to do for the band. And then afterwards, I get the band in the car and I'm really excited about it. And I turn to them and I say, what did you make of that? And they said to me, they're the best roast potatoes we've ever had. So it was like, that's all that mattered to them was the food.
But the band certainly did not reach the acclaim or success of Elton, Nevermind, Squeeze. How did you deal with that?
Well, they toured the world and put on live shows everywhere that were brilliant. You know, they were very exciting to watch. I stood at the side of the stage loads of times watching them play. They were like any band at that age. They were kind of oscillating together. But there was a kind of inner confusion about who did what, I guess. And, you know, that often happens with a young band. You're waiting to see who's going to be like the main writer or who's going to do the talking when you do the press. You know, so it had to evolve over time. The record company, you know, they gave them 3 albums and then they were kicked out of the door.
And did that break up the band?
It was about to implode anyway, because there was 2 separate writing camps. There was the guitarist wrote most of the original songs, and then the bass player and the drummer wrote the most of the songs for the 3rd album. And equally as great as Josh's songs, the guitarist, but coming from a different point of view. And I think their influences as human beings had started to change.
And are any of these people still in music professionally?
Yeah, the guitarist Josh is floating around. I think he's recorded a couple of records. I'm not sure where they are. He plays with Paul Weller every now and again. He's an amazing guitar player. The drummer and the bass player I'm in touch with, and they have a band that they play. But, you know, the music industry is so difficult for them as young men. It's not like it was when I started out.
That's for sure. Also in this era, you do some songwriting with other people. How does that come together, and to what degree is that fulfilling?
Well, for most of my life, obviously, writing with Glenn, he's like the main guy in my life. And, you know, we've had an incredible journey. And then when it came along for me to write with other people, like Elton John, I felt like I was sleeping outside of a marriage. It was difficult. I found it hard. But I then started co-writing when I started doing the songwriting camps 26 years ago. And I've been doing that ever since. And now it's like falling off a log. I really love it. And this afternoon I was writing with Kimmy Rhodes in Austin, Texas. We're working on some songs. So, you know, I'm enthusiastic about songwriting. And I write at a different speed from Glenn. And I think that's well respected between the two of us.
I.e. you write faster.
Yeah. Glenn's much more careful about what he does. And that's what makes him the genius that he is, I guess. I just want to get on with it, whether it's right or wrong.
Okay, just staying in Brighton or the general area, that would beg the question, were you a mod or a rocker, or was that something that didn't apply?
I was a skinhead when I was growing up.
Really?
Yeah, I lived on a council estate, and I was a skinhead, and we used to beat people up. But you know, I was at the back of the crowd, because I didn't really like that very much. And in fact, one of my skinhead friends came to one of my gigs recently and he said, you know what was odd about you? He said, we all be having a great big fight and you'd be sitting there with a pencil writing poetry.
So if you grew up on a council estate, that was where?
That was in Greenwich in London. It was full of skinheads. And so I had no choice. I just joined the band, I suppose. But all the while in the back of my mind, I wanted to be in a rock and roll band, and I loved music. I was tuned into The Who and the small Faces, and just the idea of being in a band, the camaraderie, just looked amazing.
Interesting you talk about the camaraderie and then certain aspects of your personality. You're a loner, but let's also go back to the council estate. So what did your parents do for a living?
Yeah, my dad worked at the gasworks. When he came home from the Second World War, he got a job at the gasworks, and he was there to the day he died. And he loved it down there, and I loved being down there with him. And my mum, she was mum to 3 boys, and then towards the latter part of her life, she got a job in a canteen.
Okay, so there are three boys. Where are you in the hierarchy?
I'm the youngest. I came 10 years after the one before, so I was a bit of a bit. I was just the last one on the rack.
Well, usually the baby, whether it's a couple of years or 10, is coddled and is treated, you know, like fine china by the parents.
They couldn't afford fine china, my parents.
Well, what I mean is that they're forgiving in a way that they might not be for the older children.
Yeah, they were kind of tired by then, I guess. But my brothers looked after me, and thank God that they did. You know, they looked out for me. My dad was constantly working, so I hardly saw him. And my mum just kept herself to herself. We lived in a tiny house, and there was music. There was food on the table. There was love, you know. So it wasn't disruptive in that kind of way until I became a young teenager and started playing music.
Now, Council Estates, from a U.S. viewpoint, is the lower economic end of the scale, and it's post-war. To what degree was it impoverished, underprivileged, or not a factor?
It was built by the local council to house people that were in temporary accommodation after the Second World War. So, for instance, before we moved in to the house we had on the estate, we were living in a prefab, which was built specifically for people who didn't have homes after the Second World War. So that was my first home. And a prefab's like a flat building, no stairs. And, you know, we were all sort of crammed in. And there was like four prefabs in a row. But they weren't very healthy places to live. They had a lot of damp, and it wasn't great. So we moved on to this council estate with lots of other people, and it quickly became sort of the nest from where the birds began to lay their eggs.
Now, as I say, we're coming from across the pond. What do we know about the UK in that era? There's limited radio, records are expensive. What was it like growing up before you actually got into a band?
Yeah, records were expensive, and you had to go miles to get them. You know, that was the great thing. You know, if like the Allman Brothers brought out a live album, I'd have to get on a bus, go all the way into London. That would take an hour and a half. I'd queue up, get a copy of the Allman Brothers, put it in my bag, get on the bus, come all the way back, and then put it on the record player. So music was so important. It meant so much more because you'd gone out of your way to get it, you know, and that's what my record collection was. It was a dedication of love, really. And whenever somebody like Todd Rundgren or Frank Zappa or someone like that would bring out a record, you know, I'd be on the bus up to London to get the first copy of it.
Well, those were the days where people would judge you based on your record collection. So what kind of kid were you growing up? Were you a member of the group? Were you good in school? What was that like?
I wasn't good at school. No, I was kind of we were looking at my school report the other day and it said I was backward. I was what you call today dyslexic. So I was put in a special class with other kids that were backward. This guy that I used to sit next to, Derek Shutt, he ate crayons, you know, and he was kind of more backward than me, but we were just there, you know. And that's when I just used to get a pencil and write down poetry. And I don't know why. I think it became a way of isolating from the rest of the class. And it became like a safe place to be amongst all these words. And the teachers didn't seem to mind what I was doing, so I felt like I was doing the right thing.
But that's kind of an interesting connection, poetry and dyslexia. Those don't tend not to go together. Maybe I'm not dyslexic and I don't understand.
Well, they don't, but there's just words. And, in those days, they were very floral or very kind of they had no meaning. They were just fun words. It was just the words were just a place to sort of exist outside of the rest of the school, I guess. But I was constantly listening to music, and that was what was influencing me. You know, I'd listen to a King Crimson record and I think, wow, the lyrics to this are amazing. You know, I want to be Pete Sinfield. I want to write lyrics like this. And so I would go off and try and copy him.
So in America, we had the folk scene, and then the Beatles came on the scene at the very beginning of 1964. They broke in the UK 62, 63. To what degree were the Beatles impactful on your sensibility and career and desires, or did it come sooner, or was it influenced by something later?
My elder brother was a massive Beatles fan, and they were an institution in our house. They were almost like religious figures. Whenever a record came out, it constantly got a spin. And at Christmas, they were always on television. They were kind of like, you know, the boys to men of their time, I guess. And they were just like constantly respect, you know, you respected them all. They didn't seem to put a foot wrong. Everything that, you know, I joined the fan club, the fan club records were amazing. The books, the magazines that used to come, they were so clean cut. You know, they were the boy next door. And so my parents accepted that that was the music that I might want to get into because it was a respectable place. But I didn't want to get into that place. You know, I'd already, at this point anyway, discovered the MC5 and the Stooges and, you know, rock and roll and stuff that was filthy. And that was because my other brother didn't like the Beatles and liked Rolling Stones. And so down his tree came Bo Diddley, the Stooges, MC5. So, you know, there was those two branches of the family tree that were rocking in different direct directions.
You had it in one house. Usually you didn't get that opposition in one house. So what point do you pick up an instrument and say, this is my destiny?
I think when I was about 14, I picked up an instrument and started writing songs. And before I met Glenn, I'd written probably 40 or 50 that I was quite pleased with. I was quite fluent, but not very good. But it didn't matter. You know, I had the ambition. The ambition was everything that I needed. And the ambition came from two very important gigs that I saw. The first one was The who played at Charlton. I went to see them. I managed to get backstage. And to be backstage to watch The Who play in front of 100,000 people in a football ground was extraordinary. It was the most exciting thing. And the camaraderie between them being in a band was like being in a gang of skinheads. You know, they were all getting on, dancing around, having fun. So I was like, okay, that's the job for me. And then a little bit before that, I'd seen David Bowie. This is pre-Ziggy, and he was playing in a local college. All the audiences in those days sat cross-legged on the floor, and David Bowie walks on and plays all these amazing songs. And the lyrics just hit me, and I think, wow, I wish I could write lyrics like that. You know, and I sort of moved away from King Crimson and from the kind of fantasy lyricism to the more sort of structured lyric.
Okay, so when do you stop going to school?
I stopped going to school in my head the day I went, really. I mean, I wasn't very good. I didn't get any results. I was always looking out the window. I wasn't bothered with it all. You know, it was the only class that I took to was the art class, and that's because we had a really beautiful art teacher called Gail. And Gail was a real sweetheart. And she was a young teacher from a local college. And she used to say to us, bring your records in and we'll play them while we're painting and drawing and stuff like that. And I was like, wow, a teacher actually has got a record collection. And after school one day, she invited me around to her house to listen to the new Fleetwood Mac album. And then she tried to seduce me.
And really?
Yeah. And I was terrified.
So what happened? You run out the door?
I ran out the door, got on the bus and went home. And the next day I went back to school and nothing was said.
How much older than you was she?
She was older than me.
Okay. Do you ever have a straight gig or you pretty much made your living as a musician?
I had a few jobs when I left school. I worked down the docks with my brother for a bit. But nothing really to write home about. I mean, the ambition was always to try and write songs and try and be in a band.
And so you say your parents disapproved of that?
They did until they saw me on telly, and then suddenly the penny dropped, and it was like, ah, oh, yeah, what a great boy you are. Fantastic. Well done.
So, okay, you're writing songs. How do you start forming bands?
I put an advert in a sweet shop window in 1973 for a guitarist to join a band. And the only person to ring was a guy called Glenn Tilbrook. It was April 1973, and I was quite nervous about meeting him for the first time. I didn't know where it was going to lead. And I met him outside a pub, him and his girlfriend Maxine. I'd recognized them from being people that I'd seen locally, so I kind of was aware of both of them because they stood out from the crowd. They were very different. They were like hippie kids, if you like. He had bare feet, she had bare feet, he had a mandolin, they had long hair, and they looked beautiful and angelic together. And there was something about it that was so beautiful that I thought, I've got to give this a go. And I went to their house, listened to some songs. We listened to some Jimi Hendrix, which Glenn was really into at that point. And then he came to my house, I played some songs, some that I'd written. And before we knew where we were, by the summer of that year, we'd written about 50 songs, I guess.
Why the sweet shop?
Why the sweet shop? Well, because I just thought, well, it's local, you know, and I thought, well, it was the advert was above bunk bed for sale, freezer for sale, you know, secondhand budgerigar cage for sale, and then guy looking for guitarist. It was kind of surreal. And I suppose I didn't know what was going to happen. I could have put an advert in the Melody Maker, which everybody did, but I didn't.
Right. Okay, so when he comes to your house and you're writing songs, is the division of duties happen pretty quickly where you're the lyricist and he's the musical end of it?
Yeah, I think it did really. Glenn recognized, I guess, a skill I'd been working on, which is the lyrical side of music. And I realized that musically, likewise, he was really good at putting songs together. So we were in a van going to a gig, and he asked me for a lyric, and I had a whole load of lyrics, and I gave him one. He wrote a tune, and to that day, to this, I've never written another tune.
And where was that in Squeeze's career?
That was before Squeeze. That was just the beginning. So he'd been at school with Jules Holland, and so he introduced me to Jules, and that was really the nucleus of the early part of Squeeze.
And how does it become Squeeze, and how do you get a manager and a record deal?
Well, a lot of rehearsing, a lot of playing in local pubs, a lot of writing songs, playing to your mates. That was the most important thing. There was a band called the Only Ones. I don't know if you remember them. And Glenn had been hanging out with one of them, and they had this guy called Lawrence. And Lawrence was a manager. And Lawrence had been at school with Stuart Copeland. And Lawrence said, you know, I'd be your manager, but I think you need someone who really knows what they're doing because you're such a great band. And that was a really nice thing for him to say. So he looked after us for a little bit, financed some of our early work. And then he introduced us to this larger-than-life character, Miles Copeland. And Miles came to our rehearsal room. We played him 15 songs, and he just wanted to sign us there and then.
And so what transpired?
Well, we signed a massive document that was like 5 feet tall. It was a publishing agreement, an agency agreement, and a record company agreement. They were all cross-collateralized. But it meant that we got 15 quid a week. So we said, yeah, we'll sign this. 15 quid a week sounds amazing. So we all, and he said to us, look, if you haven't got a lawyer, just show it to your dad. So I showed it to I showed it to my dad, who worked in the gasworks, and he said, how much are you going to get? And I said, 15 quid. He said, sign it.
And to what degree do you regret signing that today?
Well, 50% of all of the songs that I wrote with Glenn up until 91, I don't own, and I don't get the publishing for. They used to be owned by Miles. He sold the company So, yeah, it's part of the past.
Of the 100% of your interest, how much do you not get because there's the publishing and the writer side?
Well, he was the publisher, so he got 50%.
Okay, so he took all of the publishing.
Yes, and then Glenn and I would get 25%.
Right. Okay, so now what happens with making a record?
Well, punk new wave had just started to come to London, and we were going around looking at other bands like The Clash, people like that in clubs, and wondering what the hell was going on. And Miles had a friendship with John Cale from the Velvet Underground, and he suggested that we did some work with John. So our first meeting with John was extraordinary. We went to a rehearsal room, we played him 20 songs that we'd been working on, and he fell asleep. So we wrote "I Am a C-U-N-T" on his forehead in indelible ink, and we sent him back to his hotel. And the next day he came back and it was still on his forehead. But it didn't matter because, you know, he kind of said to us, he said to me in particular, "I think your lyrics are too sweet. I think if we're going to work together, you've got to sharpen your pencil and do something different." And he was kind of right, but it, you know, when you're young, you think you're right, you know, so it was a bit of a clash.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
Every week, we'll pick a new song from the list and talk about their placement on the revamped 2021 list.
We'll also have guests join us, ranging from the artists themselves to the producers, or simply other writers like ourselves who voted on them.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern-day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside and Britney Spears' Baby One More Time.
There's so many fascinating stories that have been forgotten, like Midnight Train to Georgia starting with a phone call to Farrah Fawcett, or how the Yeah Yeah Yeahs inspired Kelly Clarkson's banger Since You've Been Gone and Beyoncé's Hold Up.
Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how, I don't know where, I don't know what. God, if you show me, God, if you tell me, God, no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rocked the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storr on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So, you first and foremost, you name the band after the last Velvet Underground album, Squeeze, which really is a Doug Yule incarnation as opposed to a Lou Reed and John Cale incarnation. Then you work with John Cale. What's that about?
I know. Well, that was fate. I mean, we had lots of names that went in a hat, and Squeeze was the one that came out. Our bass player put the name in the hat. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of weird that the both of them sort of linked together. But it was, you know, looking back, thankfully, that stuff with John was really what made us individual as a band. We could have been a sweet pop band. You know, there was other record labels that wanted us to be like the Rubettes or the Bay City Rollers. You know, they wanted to mold us in that kind of way. But luckily, John Cale wanted us to be different, and he was absolutely right.
How do you end up with A&M?
Well, various labels came along. I mean, I remember Maurice Oberstein coming to see us in London at the 100 Club. And he said, I think I'm going to pass on you guys. He was very honest, and I thought that was great. It was very honest of him. He gave us the reasons why. And then the next pub we played in, Derek Green from A&M came down, and they signed us. And what I loved about A&M and about record companies in general in those days is they would stick with you. So if you had a duff record, the first one out, they'd stick with you for two or three more just to see if you had any gas in the tank. And we certainly did. So, you know, after the first album didn't really sell that many, they allowed us to record the second album with John Cale's engineer, a guy called John Wood, and the third album with John Wood, and they were successful.
Okay, yes, you have Cool for Catch, you have other hits, certainly in Los Angeles. Those are records that were played on K-Rock, yeah, which dominated the airwaves in Los Angeles, and then the programmers there ended up at MTV, which helped you. What was the experience on your end? I mean, I'm on the listening end, you're on the manufacturing and touring end.
Well, I felt like my feet weren't touching the ground. You know, we were in and out of the studio. You know, we'd get to the end of one record, then the record company would say, we want another record, like quick. So me and Glenn would have to work doubly quick when we got back from touring. And we loved touring, so we were always on the road in America or in Europe. And then we'd be back in the studio again. And luckily, Glenn forged a fantastic relationship with John Wood. So that when the songs were being produced, Glenn was very much at the helm with John, putting together the melodies and the structure, if you like. So it was a very productive 5 years, I guess. It was just a constant roller coaster of motels, tour buses, studios, hangovers, and all the bad things.
Well, you know, you're saying you love touring. What do people say? You know, it's 23 hours of hell for 1 hour of heaven on stage. Did you partake of the lifestyle on the road? The wine, women, etc.?
But of course, you know, when you're young, you know, coming to America for the first time, I remember extremely well. We got off the plane in New York. It was just amazing. You know, we get in a minibus. Miles Copeland, our manager, provided a minibus. We got in it and we drove around America for 2 months. We played absolutely everywhere that we could possibly play. And while we were there, Miles would go and knock on radio stations' doors and say, you've got to play these guys. But they were reluctant. They were playing ZZ Top and Styx and, you know, REO Speedwagon. They weren't interested in young bands from Britain at that point. So it was an uphill struggle at the very beginning, but it was a struggle that we were prepared to take on board. And we liked to have a great time, and we did. We certainly did have a great time.
And then Pulling Muscles from Michelle becomes a big radio success amongst those radio stations that will play it, as yeah, radio is transitioning from, yeah, you know, meat and potatoes rock to the British sound.
Yeah, and then I have to say that college radio saved our lives, really, because everywhere we went, we played colleges, and the college radio would be open to us playing for them. They would play our music. The kids in the college would enjoy it. They come to the gig. And then when they got older and they had families, they'd come and see us again. So it was kind of like the breeding ground for Squeeze.
And how does Jules decide to leave the band?
Well, I guess he got offered some TV work out of the blue. Miles Copeland offered him a TV in the UK called The Tube. He got an audition and he passed. And he decided to take that and to form his own band and go off and do his own thing. And I remember meeting with him and Glenn in a cafe in Blackheath. And he told us what was going to happen. And I went home and cried. I was that sad. I thought this was, you know, like one of the main members of the band had left. And I sort of was upset with Miles for not kind of keeping everything together. And then a few months later, we met a new manager and we met a new keyboard player and everything was rosy again.
And the new manager was?
Jake Riviera. And Jake Riviera.
Well, you know, Stiff Records, that's a world unto itself.
Well, it is. And Jake was creative, exciting, completely different from Miles. And fun to be around. Again, it was like being in a gang. You know, you had Elvis Costello, you had Dave Edmonds, Nick Lowe, Paul Carrack. You had this great fraternity of musicians who all wanted the same thing and wanted to do it with joy and happiness and great artistry, I suppose, even though we were pissed most of the time. It didn't seem to matter. And he came up with some great ideas, like, you know, the East Side Story album was going to be a four-sided record. Dave Edmonds was going to produce one side, then Nick Lowe one side, Elvis Costello one side, and Paul McCartney was going to record side four. We went in the studio with Nick Lowe, which was great fun, but we ended up in the pub mostly, so that never saw the light of day. Dave Edmonds did the original version of Tempted, but it didn't sound like Squeeze. And then we went in with Elvis, and it just made complete sense.
How does Paul Carrack get in the band?
Well, we didn't have a keyboard player, and there he was. And
Certainly he's had a peripatetic career after, but he starts in Ace. He does How Long? I have that album. I like it, but nothing really happens. And then he's in your band. He's playing in Mike and the Mechanics. You know, he's cutting solo. He never seems to stay anywhere.
He's with Eric Clapton. Yeah, he doesn't, but, you know, I think that keeps him healthy, you know, and he's a talent. He can sing so beautifully and emotionally that when I'm writing songs with him, I find it really hard to contain my feelings because he's such an incredibly emotional singer. So to have him in Squeeze, I didn't know that at the time, but to have him in Squeeze was just genius.
And what were the circumstances and how did you feel when he left?
Well, that's when I started to think that the chain was beginning to snap, and so did Glenn. We were tired. We toured constantly, recorded constantly, and we were doing an album with a guy called Ian McDonald, who was an engineer, and we went in to do Sweet Side Story with him in Roger Daltrey's studio in Battersea. And yeah, I was tired. Glenn was tired. And we were on a train together and we both said the same thing at the same time. I think we should rest the band. And we broke the band up, which was upsetting for everybody, including us. And we recorded Sweets from a Stranger and that was that.
Okay, but Black Coffee in Bed is a big radio success, at least in the U.S.
It was a huge radio success for us, but it was very long as a song, and I was surprised that it got...
That's what I liked about it.
Yeah, I liked it too. And when you come and see us play live, it is the longest song of the night. It's like the second set, and just in that one song. You know, Glenn was at his genius point at that. You know, we'd written When the Hangover Strikes, and then the music to that, and the music to Black Coffee in Bed were like the highlights of that part of our career. And lyrically, I felt like I was beginning to fade. The lights were beginning to get dim in my head. And so it was a good time to say goodnight. So we said goodnight in Jamaica. That was our last gig. We were on stage with Aretha Franklin, the Grateful Dead, The Clash. It was a festival. And yeah, it was kind of like a great way to go out.
Okay, but you go out, That must have been emotionally very difficult. You come home, what's the plan?
And there wasn't one. There was no plan until about 2 months later, a guy from a local theater presents Glenn and I with a script for a musical called Label with Love. Glenn and I read it. We liked it. We rehearsed the band, and it ran for 3 months. The Niederlander family from America came to see it. They wanted us to tour it in America, but we didn't want to do that. So we went off and recorded an album on our own called Difford and Tilbrook. We changed managers again.
And who was the new manager?
Shep Gordon.
Right.
And that
I know Shep very well. I forgot that point in his managerial career. So, yes, you have the new manager, and what does Shep tell you to do? Because Shep is not short on ideas.
He had some ideas about us working with Grandmaster Flash, which was surreal. And we did some tracks with them in New Jersey. But the coming together was strange. It didn't really work. It felt like it could have worked with a bit more input from myself and Glenn, possibly, but it didn't really seem like it was going to fit. So we went off and recorded the Difford and Tilbrook album with Eric Thorngren, and Eric Thorngren was their engineer. And he'd never been out of that studio with Grandmaster Flash, so it was like a new beginning for him too. He went on to record with the Talking Heads and stuff. So he came to London and helped us finish that album.
And so how do you decide to become Squeeze again?
It was very easy. the Difford and Tilbrook album was a masterpiece on reflection, but not at the time. Glenn's genius was at the forefront musically, I think. He was working on it with Tony Visconti. And we took it to the record company and they turned it down. They didn't like what Tony had done. And that's the only time Tony Visconti's been turned down by a record label, I have to let you know. So that was kind of sad. So then we get that somebody approaches Glenn about doing a charity gig locally and so we get Jules, Gilson, everybody back in the band, and we go in the pub, we play, the electricity is reformed, we're oscillating as a band again, and then we're off to the races. But what do? We call Miles Copeland, and Miles comes back to manage us again. And why do we do that? Because he's got such a great relationship with A&M because of the Police, that we figure that we can get as many doors open for us as possible. And to some degree, that did work. You know, Miles had a lot of weight to throw around, and that helped us record the next few albums.
But ultimately, A&M rejects you and you jump to Reprise.
Yeah, that was weird. We got to the stage where we dumped Miles again, and they phoned us up and they just said, I'm sorry, you've come to the end of the road. And then Glenn and I were like, oh my God, what are we going to do now? Not another hurdle to jump over. And then the next day we get a phone call from Lenny Wanaker, and he says to us, I want you guys on Warner Brothers. Come to Los Angeles and record an album with Tony Berg. So we go to Los Angeles, and that's where I hit my darkest point in my life, right at the beginning of the recording of that record.
Why?
I think I'd kind of taken too many drugs, drunk too much, isolated too much. I'd lost any communication skills I had with the band, particularly with Glenn, and I regret that. And Glenn had this great vision that we would all be in like a house in Los Angeles, like when the band got together to record. But as soon as we got to Los Angeles, I checked out of the house, got myself an apartment on Venice Beach, and drew the curtains and isolated from everybody, and left Glenn really to sort of hold court. And he and Tony did all the work on that record. But emotionally, I kind of was dried up, I guess.
Well, on that album, which many people consider to be not one of the band's high points, is Satisfied, which is one of my favorite Squeeze tunes.
Absolutely. It's one of mine, too. And it's a terrific song that we never play live, but wish it that we did. And I think the production of that was recorded in Tony's garden shed is amazing. It's just an amazing thing.
And then you go back to A&M. How does that happen?
Oh, we've had a checkered past. Well, they had a change of heart at the top of the label, and they decided that, well, you know, we've got their back catalogue. How can we enhance their new catalogue? We gave them some new songs. Some Fantastic Place came along. I'd been in rehab. I was on a Pink Cloud. Some Fantastic Place was a great record. We had Pete Thomas in the band playing drums. We had Paul Carrack back in the band. And for me, that was like a genius time. You know, we were really back in the saddle there, I think.
Yes, but needless to say, while you were doing all this, musical trends were changing.
Yes, they were.
Over the 15 years. So certainly your sound can be in and can be out. What was that like in terms of making music? Certainly in that era, the Seattle sound was becoming very big.
Yeah, it was. You know, the A&R guys were saying, hey, you should sound a bit more like Blur, or you should sound a bit more like Oasis. You know, like they were trying to sort of guide us, and we're saying, well, no, we want to sound like Squeeze, thank you very much. And then secretly they would send our songs off to be mixed by people in Sweden, and it was like, what the hell are you doing that for? You know, it's like stupid. So it started to peter out again, you know. I mean, It's extraordinary. We've been extraordinarily lucky to bump along the rock and roll road.
And about the same time, Jules starts his road to real stardom on the tube in the UK. What are your thoughts there?
I've always remained great friends with Jules. I sing in his orchestra every now and again. There's a tour at the end of this year that I'm supposed to be on singing with him. I write with Jules. I've never been far from his side, and I really enjoy our friendship. It goes back many years, after all. And I really was not jealous of what he did. I was in awe, and it was great to hang out with him.
But did you foresee this giant success?
No, I didn't, but it seems now natural. You know, he's on television all the time, and thankfully he is introducing fantastic music to a younger crowd. So that's, you know, there's very little music on television, as you well know. So to have something like Jules's show is just a tiny bit of fresh air for people to tune into.
So one must ask, over this long career with no absolute staples, how this worked out financially for you over all these five decades almost?
Well, there were times when royalties and PRS would come through the door, and I would go and buy a Maserati or fly Concorde every other week. Consequently, I ran out of all the money, you know, it all went. And now we're at the other end of the arc where royalties don't mean very much. People don't buy records, obviously, so the Spotify don't pay you particularly well. So the royalties have died out, and it's all about being on the road as Squeeze and about trying to reinvent who we are in a digital world, if you like.
Let's just assume you never toured again. Do you have enough money to get to the end?
No, I definitely don't. You know, I know, as Nick Lowe says, we're in the final third. I think that's a lovely quote. And we're in the final third. And I wouldn't want to stop anyway. I've only just in the last 10 years begun to own the fact that I am one half of Squeeze. And that I do enjoy who I am, and I like to sing the songs. And that's taken a lot of therapy, a lot of time, a lot of understanding and a lot of respect for the people that I work with, particularly Glenn. It's taken a long time for me to hold his hand.
Oh, what did you believe previously?
I don't know what I believed, but it always seemed to me like the competition was fruitless, really. And yeah, I wanted to be in competition the whole time. I couldn't sing like Glenn. I can't sing like Paul Carrack. But I learned to sing like me. And so when I do Black Coffee in bed myself, it sounds like me. And I think that's absolutely fine. And when I go out and do my solo stand-up show, which is like an hour long, I tell tales, I tell jokes, and I play a couple of songs. It's kind of, that's all I really, really need. I enjoy that. I enjoy the camaraderie of Squeeze again, and I'm really missing not being on tour, not just for the band, but for the crew, for the audience, for the whole chemistry of what being a human being is all about.
Let's go back to prior to that realization. So you felt like less than half?
I did, because I just couldn't handle, I suppose, the fact that I found it difficult to play the guitar. I found it difficult to sing. That kind of guy that was the dyslexic backward kid who was in the special needs class, that was always me and Squeeze in my head. And I couldn't express that to other people in the band. So I used to just dwell on it and be isolated. But I don't have to be that person anymore. I am much more confident. And I really have our audience to thank for that. And I have the people that are around Squeeze to thank for that too. And my wife, Louise, who constantly holds my hand.
Well, let me put it this way. Other than Squeeze, when you look at the world at large, prior to this realization, did you feel less than, or did you put other people on a pedestal?
Yeah, I did feel less than, and I did put, when you're in a band and the lead singer is also the lead guitarist and he writes all the melodies and he's the one all the girls look at, you kind of step backwards towards your amplifier just a little quicker because you don't feel like you can be that guy. But that's okay. It's like not everybody can be Pete Townsend and not everybody can be Roger Daltrey. So if I was one of them, I was probably Roger.
Well, I guess that the reason I go deeper here is, I'm stunned at these people who are big successes in their 20s and 30s. I was brought up in a family where they always said somebody else can do better. And it hasn't been till like the last year that I've had this realization like you have. Well, I'm here. I'm on the landscape. I'm equal.
Absolutely.
But I know people would verbalize that before, yeah. But I never believed it.
I never believed it either. And, that's acceptance, and it comes with age, I think. And I think I'm very fortunate to be in the place that I'm at. There's no rush anymore to do anything particularly, there's no rush to make a new album, although I would love to make a new album. I think this being in lockdown is like being in 1973. It's kind of like there's nothing to do. You kind of sit around, and I've just been starting writing songs again, so I'm in a good frame of mind. And I'm looking forward to the day when we get back out there.
So what is your personal songwriting process?
Well, I sit at my desk where I am now, and I wait for lyrics to arrive. I don't go chasing them. I might get an idea, like today I had an idea and it came to me. I put down the idea on my computer screen and it just poured out. It just came straight out. And I sent it to a friend of mine in Austin and she just wrote the music for it.
Well, I guess what I'm asking, are you the type of person, it's 10 a.m., I have to go to the shed and write, or are you waiting for inspiration?
No, I'm fortunate insofar as Whenever the muse takes me, I will sit in the shed for as long as it takes to write whatever I need to write. You know, the Randy Newman school of going in the morning from 10 o'clock till 5 suits me fine. That sounds great. That's what I love to do. So, for instance, if we were going to make a new Squeeze record, that's what I would do. I'd cut myself off from 10 to 5 every day.
Okay. Are your best songs written when you say, I have to work, or when lightning strikes?
The best songs I've ever written are from the subconscious mind. They just appear. I don't know what they're about or where they come from. And then you go out on the road and people interview you and they say, oh, what's that song about? And you go, well, actually, I have to think about that. You know, because sometimes it comes from the back part of the brain, which is kind of floating around like, in sunlight. And it takes a while for it to seep through into the lower valleys of the front of the mind.
Well, like today you say this poured out of you. Once it pours out of you, is that it, or do you change it, and to what degree do you change it?
Well, it depends who I'm working with. I'm writing for Glenn. I have Glenn right in the middle of my mind, and I think about Glenn constantly while I'm writing, because he's the guy who's going to be singing it. So, and I've got to think about his personality, what he feels, what he believes, and try and get into what he would like to sing. If I'm writing with Paul Carrack, I try and think about what Paul would like to sing. So it's rather like being a tailor, you know, lyrically, I've got to kind of dress the person in something that would suit them best.
Well, I guess let's just assume you don't have a raw inspiration, but you want to write. You go out to the shed. Are you a procrastinator? Do you have to surf the web, sharpen your pencils, or do you go right into it?
Oh, no, I don't do it. I use this software called IA Writer, and IA Writer is just a black screen with white typing on it. There's nothing around the outside of the screen, so you only see the words. And I just sit here and I type and imagine, and I don't stress, and I just let it come. And then I'll come back the following day and read it, and if it's rubbish, I just don't bother finishing it. If it's good, then I finish it.
Is it sometimes hard to get into the same mood from what you've done before and to finish the song?
Not really, no. I'm kind of, once I'm in the groove to write, it comes thick and fast. And, you know, that's what I try and get across to the writers that I'm teaching, that they have to go with their instinct and not really challenge themselves or make it difficult for themselves, but just go with how you feel within. You know, it's a gift, after all, having the ability to write lyrics, I feel. So, you know, you have to nurture the gift and be with it.
So let's just assume you finish a song. Would you change it, or it's done, it's done?
Well, again, it's who I'm working with. If I'm working with Glenn, we normally tweak the songs lyrically. We might change a word or two. And on the last two albums of Squeeze, Glenn has contributed quite a lot lyrically himself. So that's been a different dynamic for both of us. And that's been fun and different for us. And then if I'm working with somebody else, I probably wouldn't tweak it quite as much, I don't think.
Now, when you say Glenn writes lyrics, that's after you've established something. He then changes it, or he comes with his own lyrics?
No, he predominantly, on the last couple of records, he's changed some of the inferences of the lyrics, kept what he feels are the best lines, I guess, and then embellishes it with his own structure and his own ideas. And I suppose that's what co-writing is about. It's about being able to share. That has never happened until recently, I have to say. So, you know, we've for a long time had the Bernie Taupin, Elton John relationship, but without the money, where, you know, I would deliver the lyrics, walk away, and then the next thing we'd be on stage playing these songs. But that dynamic has changed.
And what lyrics are you most proud of?
Geez, I'm proud of a lot of the earlier stuff, particularly the East Side Story album. I was talking about this the other day, that it's the most complete album from a lyrical point of view that I feel very proud of every track. And I think that's because Elvis Costello was producing it. And Elvis is a dear friend, and a dear friend because I respect him so much as a writer. So when we're in the studio together, he would be like the teacher that I would be trying to impress. So I'd come in with a lyric and I'd read it to him, or Glenn would sing him a song, and I'd be looking at him for a reaction. And that's what made that record special. So sometimes having a producer come in from the outside can really enhance your songwriting skills. And it makes it less kind of, it gives it more oxygen, I think.
And let's assume you're not on a project. Hmm. Are you writing anyway?
Yeah, I'm trying to write short stories, which I'm learning a lot about. I'm constantly writing down notes about lyrics, or I'm working on the next Zoom concert. I got Nile Rodgers is joining me on the next one, which I'm looking forward to. And then if I'm not doing that, then I'm teaching, or, you know, I'm just sort of focusing on staying in the day.
Okay, so who do you respect lyrically?
Well, it's got to be people like Joni Mitchell, Pete Townsend. It's people from the past in many ways. Alex Turner is a lyricist of most recent years that I love. I think he's just a complete genius. There's a lyricist called Chris Wood, who's a folk singer who I really like. Other than that, it's few and far between, I guess.
Can you name any specific Joni Mitchell or Pete Townsend songs?
You know, when I listen to the Blue album, I mean, it's an obvious album to take, but lyrically, it's a very moving record. And, you know, when I listen to that record, it takes me to a very soft and feminine place. Unlike the new Bob Dylan record, which doesn't take me to a feminine place, but it takes me to a place of inspiration. So there are still still people from the generation before that impressed, like Dylan, Neil Young's new album.
Well, Neil Young's new album, Homegrown, is certainly, and it's very good, recorded from a previous era.
It
certainly
is.
Bob Dylan has been through a lot of changes, and I'm a big Dylan fan, but I thought the two previous records were overrated, and that seems to be the word now. In terms of the new record, it's something I can respect, but I don't find that easy to listen to. What has your experience been?
Exactly that. But that's the challenge for me. You know, it's on repeat in the car because I find it sometimes difficult to listen to, and I'm not sure what that is. So I want to get to the bottom of it by constantly listening to it. But it's the lyrical challenge that he throws up that is the most important thing. He's portraying such beautiful imagery that I could only dream of writing, and that's why I indulge in that kind of lyric.
Okay, so needless to say, you started your career in the pre-internet era. What do you think about business and music today?
Well, I don't know anything about business and music today. It doesn't exist for me. We're on the outskirts of that. We used to be very heavily in the middle with A&M and Warner Brothers and Universal and people like that, but that's not our, you know, that we were in the department store, I guess, in the shopping mall of music industry in those days. Now we're the corner shop. You know, we've just got a few things that we sell, but they're fresh, you know, fresh fruits and fresh vegetables and stuff. And that's really, I remember Pete Townsend saying to me, you know, you've got to stop thinking of Squeezers as like, you know, the big shop that you're working in. You're working in a corner shop now, you know, and that's exactly what it's like. And I love that. I think it's great. And we have more fans now than I think we've ever had. We played in Atlanta in September, and our audience was so young. when we came on stage, I looked at Glenn, he looked at me and we went, are we at the right gig? You know, and this is an audience that had found us, I guess, via Spotify, you know, and via the internet. So we are a new band.
Just broadening our horizons, leaving Squeeze out of it, do you pay attention to what's popular on the charts, what is being released, or you say, I'm in Squeeze world?
Yeah, I take on board what's going on in the industry. You know, I listen to things that I think are great, like Laura Marlin, I'd love to listen to. Things that come along and stroke my imagination lyrically. But other than that, not really that fast. It's not for me. It's for a different generation.
Which begs the question of hip hop.
Yeah, that's not really my thing, I don't think. Lyrically, I love Stormzy. I love Dave. I think they're both incredible lyricists. They're like, you know, they're like the Dickens of their day. People like that are extraordinary storytellers. And that's what I find very appealing about that kind of music when it's done right.
Well, Chris, I think people have really gotten an idea of who you are. You've certainly become more 3D than what I've known previously, even being on one of your webcasts. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you. It's been an honor.
Till next time, this is Bob Lefsetz.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside.
Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.